Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Life gets messy. Spills, stains, and kid chaos. But with Anabe, cleaning up is easy. Our sofas are fully machine washable, inside and out, so you never have to stress about messes again. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Get early access to Black Friday pricing right now. Sofas start at just $699. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Definable proof that there is a God and he loves us. Voodoo Child, Slight Return by Hendrix. Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child is a unique tribute to Jimi Hendrix, featuring contributions by those who knew and worked with him, enhanced with images by the most renowned rock photographers of the era. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the States, co-author of Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child, Harvey Kurbanek. Harvey, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Delighted to talk to you. What a way to start a Friday in L.A. and just knowing that Miles Davis' Sketches of Spain was one of Jimi Hendrix's favorite albums to listen to.
It was indeed. And I mean, that's the later Hendrix, isn't it? I mean, that is the band, yeah. The Gypsies Hendrix. And, you know, one of the great tragedies is that, you know, Jimmy died at 27 and he was just starting to go off in a really interesting direction that, you know, his contemporaries perhaps weren't doing so much. Hendrix sort of sprung onto an unsuspecting world, an unsuspecting British rock scene, first of all, of course, because it was kind of Chas Chandler who discovered him, wasn't it?
Yes, but, you know, he had been around, you know, playing in the States, through the South, through New York, all through Los Angeles and Hollywood. You know, this is as early as 1963, 64. I mean, you know, in Tennessee when he's in the military. He had put in some years touring in various configurations, whether it be auditioning for the OJs in L.A., whether it be playing with the Ronettes, whether it playing a stint with Little Richard, on the road and at Ciro's in Hollywood. So he had been a work in progress, and then Chas Chandler, through the help and support of Linda Keith, really helped set up the situation where he would cross the pond. And, you know, the Brits, who are steeped in blues and jazz, and I'm talking about the unsuspecting public and the media and the writers and the journalists and the radio stations, immediately grasped that this was somebody we should really pay attention to.
And it's really interesting because, you know, Hendrix, you know, earns his chaps. He does all that work with, as you said, Little Richard, the Ronettes, which, I mean, that just blows my mind. Wilson Pickett as well, didn't he?
Joe Tex and all kinds of people, even Bobby Womack and I. Well, he was a neighbor of mine. He used to tell me stories about seeing Jimmy tour with some characters all through the South on the Chitlin circuit, a guy named George. So and Bobby, you know, would encounter Jimmy, like when he was even working with Sam Cooke. They would just cross paths, either maybe at an airport or a diner. They were on the road constantly and interacting with each other.
But was there any sort of indication that he would go on to, you know, to do what he has? Because you play a Hendrix solo, or you put a Hendrix record on, and immediately people know it's Hendrix. And very few people can cover a Hendrix song and do it well. I think only Stevie Ray Vaughan may, you know, maybe gets close. But otherwise, that sound, this, the, you know, he had the great art of making it look easy, the way he throws licks in and the way he's having a great time doing it. You can just hear him sort of laughing, you know, if I don't see you any more in this one, I'll see you the next one. And a laugh. Everybody else was being serious and studious and you know, very scholarly about the whole situation.
You know, in working with my brother Kenneth on doing a book on Jimi Hendrix, it's both a privilege, an obligation. It's a challenge, to bring new information forward, which we totally accomplished. But there was just something about Jimi Hendrix, like just you playing this track right now. Your Friday is different just starting by hearing him. Even if it's a 5-minute buzz or you flash on it, you know, at lunch or something, there are some people, some artists, visually, cinematically, and in music, the sonic gems, the breadcrumbs they leave for us, they just stick in our craw. And he just was one of those people. I mean, I have a bunch of new theories about the ascension of Jimi Hendrix and the penetration on all of us. And I never met him. I did a session with the drummer, Mitch Mitchell. I saw him play live. But I do feel one thing. He had such a hard scrabble upbringing. And he'd already, you know, he'd been through the military as a paratrooper. And I know one of the joys in his life when he got a first real record deal and went on tour, he was just so happy to have bunking and lodging and a steak dinner occasionally. He was so happy from where he came from. I mean, there's a scene in the book. I mean, I am from Hollywood. We do write cinematically.
Okay.
Where he auditions for a group, the OJs, in downtown Los Angeles, and Johnny Eccles, who was soon to be in one of my favorite groups, Love with Arthur Lee, remembers Jimmy auditioning there and putting deodorant on his clothing because he didn't even have the time or money to go to a laundromat to do his stage wardrobe. So when he got to play guitar in front of people and get some sort of payment and have this adulation as well as the respect of guitarists, it was pure pleasure we got from him on stage. Now, off the boards might have been a different story, but he was happy playing, and we were happy receiving.
And that's the thing that goes through. There's a tremendous energy. If you see, you know, now the famous, the iconic Monterey 67, and you know that's a concert. That's supposed to be a jazz event, isn't it? Originally, and you've got Janis, you've got Otis Redding, and you've got Jimmy. You know, all doing that. You know, that same sort of weekend performance. But it's the live performance, and it's the joy and you know, you can go on stage and put your head down and twiddle and fiddle and whatever. But if you don't connect with the audience, you're gone.
Well, you're talking to the right dude. My brother and I wrote an authorized book on the Monterey International Pop Festival and worked very closely with one of the co-producers, Lou Adler, on it. And Lou and I had extensive conversations and interviews, of course, about the Monterey event. And I think it's sometimes lost on people. Jimmy is a West Coast boy. That's actually a title of like one of the Sanctions albums by him. It's not derogatory calling him West Coast boy, West Coast Seattle boy, I'm sorry. It's praise, it's bold, it's challenging. And so when he came back to the West Coast to be on the Monterey bill, and he had made quite a buzz, obviously, in England, and then came in to join the festival, he was returning to the West Coast. he's near Seattle. Of course, he's in Northern California, and there's something. He's not in his hometown, but it's a homecoming for him. And there are people in the audience, like Chris Hillman of the Byrds and Roger McGuinn of the Byrds, who had seen him play 18 months earlier with Little Richard on Sunset Strip. And now they made note of him even there, that he was really special playing with Little Richard. And then they put the math together the way Mickey Dolenz had seen Jimi Hendrix earlier in Greenwich Village in New York. I think he was Jimmy James by then, or at the time. And all of a sudden he did the math on the spot. Wait a second, that's the guy that I saw in a nightclub. He needs to open some of our Monkees tour in 67. So it was a moment, and Jimmy seized the moment. And he wasn't doing it out of revenge and getting back at his old school who taunted him or body shamed him or any of that. He was playing, from an audience, and he took them by surprise.
And not only that, and there's some great footage, which, Mickey Dolenz, because many of us just think Mickey Dolenz is the Monkees and, you know, that sort of proto boy band. But, you know, he had an influence. He had clout, didn't he? He had, you know, in that scene of the mid to late 60s.
Wait a second. You're talking to my fellow Pisces, Mickey Dolenz. No, I've interviewed him. He's actually the subject of a cover story I've done for the new Record Collector News magazine. And Mickey, like many of the guys in the Monkees, they were also talent scouts and almost A&R men, and they had clout in retail success that they were able to put people on dates, whether it tours. I mean, if you looked at Mickey Dolenz and the Monkees and the acts that they put on, from the Fifth Dimension to Jill Akins to Jimi Hendrix to putting Charlie Smalls or Godfrey Cambridge or people on their television show, talk about diversity booking. When they're the headliner and they're on television and network series and doing a global tour, think about the gatekeeping that they, simply by suggesting, we'd like you to open some shows. And, you know, I've talked to some of the members of the Rolling Stones about this. They always had the clout to put on Buddy Guy opening, or when I saw a couple of shows in the late 60s with the Stones at the Inglewood Forum, Ike and Tina Turner's Review and B.B. King opened the shows for them on an entire 69 tour. So that's some of the magic of Monterey and some of the magic the Stones carry, where they have success and they give platform for deserving people. Oh, the Stones had Prince open some dates in 1981. So it's a long showbiz tradition. It's stuff Sammy Davis Jr. would talk about, working with the Rat Pack and playing Ciro's and being on a bill with Janis Paige. I mean, this stuff goes way, way back.
Also, it was the way that Jimmy then sort of took over, but there didn't seem to be the ego, there didn't seem to be the rock star behavior per se. I mean, I know it's a little bit before we get Led Zeppelin trashing hotel rooms and various goings on with fresh seafood, but he almost seemed humble off stage. You see interviews with Jimmy, you know, doing the interview circuit on TV, and he's really calm. He's not an Alice Cooper. He's not screaming and shouting. He's just lay back and speaking his truth, if you like.
I've been keeping mental notes on Jimi Hendrix, and again, I'm not an obsessive. I have maybe 6 books on him and a lot of records. But since the day I heard him, and I lay claim that I was one of the first people at stateside on the radio dial to ever hear a Jimi Hendrix recording, simply because I knew the promotional man as a kid who worked at Reprise Records, who brought an advance acetate of some of the first British pressings that were going to come out in North America through the Reprise label. And I got to hear them on Southern California radio show, because the parent company, Reprise Records, was based in Burbank. I had never heard a sound like that. I think it was KFWB, B. Mitchell Reed show. He was the disc jockey. I said, what is this? And years later, I talked to the man, Russ Regan, who helped sign Elton John to North America and deal at Universal MCA Records. And I said, what do you remember when you heard the first acetate, because he was working closely with Mo Oster, the president of the label. Russ was running the Loma label, which was sort of an R&B division of Warner Brothers. And Russ said to Mo Austin, this will either do nothing or go all the way. And either you got Jimi Hendrix or you didn't get Jimi Hendrix. Now, retrospectively, post, you know, death, sadly, everybody is getting Jimi Hendrix more than ever. But in the hundreds of interviews I've conducted regarding Jimi Hendrix, my brother did many as well with some of the prog and jazz musicians. The writers or the musicians who encountered him, they paint a picture of a shy, humble person. And I think once he gets on stage, it is such a release. And because he is concentrating playing music or dealing with repertoire, and he, you know, dealing with people that, at least in the first incarnation of his group, the Jimi Hendrix Experience, you know, like the Monkees, I wouldn't want to say they were manufactured, but here's your bass player, here's your drummer, you've got a group here. This isn't like touring on the Chitlin circuit or going out, you know, on Memphis for a weekend with somebody. So, or Curtis Knight, for example, who he worked with. He made an impression.
And not only that, though, you mentioned the touring, but 1967, he gets two albums out, Axis Bold of Love, I Experience. But the touring was brutal. I mean, they were just doing everywhere.
I mean, I think obviously that was a contributing factor to his physical demise, emotional demise, and of course, leaving the planet. Touring and routing was a little different back then. And Jimmy's management at the time, we've heard the term, overworked him. And it was just one of those torture tours, especially the 67 and all through the 68 tour. It's sort of like Elvis Presley, who I discovered Jimmy, you know, really liked and saw and actually recorded a hotel version of Hound Dog. I talked to the songwriting team, Lieber and Stoller, about Jimmy knowing about their catalog. And like the last year of Elvis Presley's life, that was the year he did the most live shows or live sets that last year. That's not said about Jimmy in 69 and 70, but that 68 United States tour and the touring of that year, you know, going into 69 pre-Woodstock, that was those dates night after night, even though it was a bit of a package tour, and Jimmy wasn't doing 2.5 or 3 hour shows on stage, but still the archaic, you know, touring in a van, you know, there was bus rides, and of course there was planes and everything, but he went on the road a whole lot, and then later he had to do a lot more dates to help finance the recording studio, Electric Lady.
Yeah.
Did he have time to enjoy a lot of this stuff like some people? The fees for payment back then were so minimal compared to what people are getting this century.
And he had an awareness of what was around. There's a great story about I think it's Paul McCartney and George Harrison going to see Jimi Hendrix play the week after Sgt. Pepper comes out, and he opens his own show with a version of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
He did that, I believe, at maybe the Seville Theater. And in fact, when I interviewed Roger Daltrey about Jimi Hendrix, he said, "You know, I was hanging out with him a lot at Monterey." And even in the warm-up and under the stage, he said Jimmy played the whole top line of the Sgt. Pepper's tune to him. He didn't do it on stage that night, but he really understood the Beatles, and just like he understood Bob Dylan. And, you know, there was a sense of, there was competition, but there was also camaraderie in the music world, and especially in the British music world, and this extends, believe me, to the artists of France and Spain and everybody. Only in Hollywood do things like collaboration play second seat to competition. But Pete Townsend has totally gone on record hundreds of times touting Jimmy as well as Mick Jagger. It just keeps going on and on.
And there's another, the thing is, I mean, as I said at the beginning of the interview, if you look at those last couple of, I mean, everybody knows the Woodstock where he plays on the Monday morning and nobody's there, mm-hmm. kind of thing. And then you look at the Isle of Wight Festival as well. I think he does a blinding set there. And then there's the Maui set where he looks mm-hmm. really unwell. I mean, he looks like he's, you know, very strung out. But he changed direction, and this is the thing. You know, he gets rid of the experience, and he goes into Band of Gypsies, and you can see that he is, as you said at the beginning, you know, that Miles Davis, he's looking to expand his repertoire and what he can do, because he doesn't want to be, you can sense he doesn't want to be playing Voodoo Child in that way for the next 20 to 30 years in the way that...
And again, he was slated to do an album with Gil Evans, the noted arranger who did a lot of work with Miles Davis. Jimmy was coming from a world, again, of hour and 15-minute sets at the most, actually probably 50-minute sets, and you were trapped playing your hits. You very rarely deviated from repertoire. Those were the audience expectations, management's demands. And of course, Jimmy could play a solo and go veer off into, you know, Strangers in the Night and things like that. We only had hoped that once he was with us through the 70s, well into the 70s maybe, who knows if he would have ever played with an orchestra. Who knows if he would have started implementing brass on stage. I mean, he was positioned to do those things if he could have escaped the quagmire and the quicksand and the pitfalls of show business and the toxic environment around him. People come up to me and say, look what he did in 4 years as far as his recorded and art output. And it used to depress me a little bit, because I haven't been working on this book for over 55 years. I've been taking notes, and then my brother said, actually, it was Keith Richard, of all people, 5 years ago, I went to a Rolling Stones rehearsal, and he was sort of like, well, what are you working on, mate? And I said, I don't know yet, something's coming, but I think I'm in a position to suggest a book on Jimi Hendrix, because my brother and I are going to do it different like nobody. And he said, is Jack Nietzsche and Linda going to be in it? And he knew that I knew it was, of course, Linda Keith. And I said, mate, there's going to be a picture of Linda Keith. And there is. And that he didn't spur it, but he reinforced it. And so I knew we brought a lot of new data to the table. I don't have to answer any more questions. What are you working on a Jimi Hendrix book for? What? That's your next thing? I mean, after 50 years and 20 books, or five of them with my brother, I get to do what I want to do, and publishers are receptive to some of the ideas, and I think it's all in this book big time.
I mean, this is a thing, because Hendrix has been dissected and misrepresented, since he left us 50 years ago, but you are able to tap in, if you like, to the mother node, as it were, because you know, as I said before, you were there or thereabouts, and people talk to you.
I think the one, I wouldn't want to call it hidden factor, because I'm an open book. I'm a native of Los Angeles. I'm a product of Hollywood. When I was doing some research, and I am the research. I realized that Jimmy's relationship to the West Coast, especially Hollywood and L.A., really didn't ever get the coverage it needed. And I said to myself, my God, I've been at Sunset Sound Recording Studio. I've been at TDG Recording Studio. I've been at Reprise Records in Hollywood. I've met 40 people who knew him, and a lot of his engineers and co-producers and bandmates. And I was saying, does anybody realize there are so many untold stories about Jimmy, his time in New York, with the Band of Gypsies, or just recording in L.A. and playing at the Hollywood Palladium at Teenage Fair, or doing one of his earliest recording sessions at Gold Star Recording Studios in Hollywood. He played on a session with Arthur Lee, who would form Love for a Woman named Rosalie Brooks, My Diary, a single on an L.A. independent label. He had houses he rented in Hollywood. He played numerous gigs at a club called The Experience. When all the documentation talks him about living in Hollywood and playing a few gigs at the Whiskey A Go-Go, or headlining a show at the Inglewood Forum or the Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino, we take you down the rabbit hole control, and we control the flashlight.
You see, the thing just hit my old grey matter, Harvey, is the fact that, yeah, because, you know, being a Brit, we kind of think Hendrix is one of our own in London. But didn't Hendrix have... Didn't the house that Hendrix had, Chili Peppers recorded some of the stuff for Blood, Sex, Sugar, Magic there, I think. Is that the same?
That's a house that, you know, Rick Rubin had a recording studio in, and I interviewed Rick for another book about this. I'm a guy that took my driver's test in Laurel Canyon, yards under that house that Jimmy resided in. So that gave him access to go to some restaurants in Hollywood, to go to Freedom Guitars, to go to the Hollywood Palladium, to check out a bunch of bands, to go to a recording session by a group called Touch at Sunset Sound Studios. There are so many, and by the way, these are not drug scenes. These are not sexually graphic situations. My brother and I made a pact to ourselves. This would be a book where the engineers and the technicians and the fans and the proletariat would get the same action as the known voices and the people we're expected to hear from. And we just took it into some new dimensions. And, you know, it's a very freeing experience because, again, I saw Jimi Hendrix live in June of 69, just after I graduated high school. And it was before I was starting junior college and getting my first real job in the school library, which I'm proud to say I initiated the subscriptions to Jet, Ebony, Downbeat, and Ramparts magazine.
Excellent.
And I didn't get kicked out or lose my gig. But when I saw Jimmy play live, and it wasn't a very good gig, it was at a festival, but he did a version of Red House that was about 11 minutes long. And we've all had moments at sports events or concerts or with your significant other, however you want to draft it, where the world stands still and you say to yourself, what are the possibilities of this relationship or this moment or what's the path I can take? And I realized I wasn't going to be a doctor or a lawyer and that I would try to be a reader. And I would try to be a record collector, and I would be a library science major. That was what I put in to get out of the draft. I had a student deferment, and Jimmy propelled me in that direction. He played a part like so much of rock and roll and art that I have walked through, and I think this book really shows. I mean, this is the most naked book for me because it reveals my Rolodex. It shows the contacts of the weave I put together and the whole brew. And I the compliments I get that mean a lot to me was somebody will come up in a store and go, oh my God, I met this person. I went to this concert with the guy you interviewed and all that. And it's a really wonderful, positive feedback.
The book is called, we're going to run out of time because I'm going to crash the news, and I could speak to you, Harvey, about this for probably the rest of the weekend. The book is called Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child. It's by Harvey Kubinick and Ken, his brother Kenneth. It's out now. You can get hold of it on Sterling Publishing. Harvey, if people want to find you, do you do the social, is there a website? Do you do a social media thing? Where can people find you online?
There is a website called Kubernick's Corner.
Ah, Kubernick's Corner.
Look up Kubernick's Corner.
Absolutely.
It's my literary documentary and music activities, and there's information on my previous books, and there's a bunch of reviews of the Hendrix book, and, you know, just delighted to talk to somebody like you who I know. We have a term, Graham Nash and I joke about this, we have a term when we talk to really knowledgeable people who really have done the research, not for interviews, but know their subject matter independent of us, we call it reissue tissue. So we have discussed the reissue tissue today big time. So I appreciate the forum and your listenership and all the people, you know, worldwide checking in on it. We're both in service to the music and, you know, And I know you're a big Prince fan, aren't you?
I am indeed as well. You know that. We know the things. Harvey, we'll get you back. Don't worry. I will drag you back on the show to talk all more things.
I'll see you in Spain, mate. Thank you.
Pleasure is all mine. This book is called Jimi Hendrix Video Child by Harvey Kubinick. Harvey, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here, wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speeds low after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.